Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'm glad to have my co-host, Dr. Catherine Koh, back with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be back again.
It's wonderful to have you here. And on to our show today, Catherine, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Ford, Assistant Professor and Director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program at the University of North Carolina, about pulmonary hypertension. I think this is something interesting. It's like, I kind of know about it, but I really would like to know more.
Right, yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about what pulmonary hypertension is, possible treatments, and then also prevention as well, and what his program can give to patients.
Yeah, you know, all the patients who we have that smoke, all the patients that are overweight, which is a lot of our patients, there's a lot of conditions that can lead to at least one form of this, and some of the treatments are new, so I look forward to that. But first, we have some research that matters to talk about, some new research, one about patients wanting online access to you and I. Should we give it to them?
Yeah, definitely interesting. And then another study that found that too few older heart attack patients are getting implanted defibrillators.
A new potential therapy for fibromyalgia, oxygen, but is it affordable?
And then should we be paying closer attention to our young adults who have slightly elevated blood pressure?
It's just a little high.
Just a little high.
Yeah,
we'll check it next time.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out. Well, let's dive right in here, which is about this online access to doctors. And I know Christy and I have talked about this in some research on the show before, you know, saying that, you know, should, for instance, doctors be Facebook friends with patients? And we've talked about that. And Christy and I kind of like, well, sometimes it just happens that way. Some of your friends are your patients and they're your friends too.
Right, exactly. And where do you sort of draw that line to being friends and then also being a medical professional? So it was a national survey of retail pharmacy customers, about 2,200, and they asked them whether or not they'd like access to their doctors on either Facebook or email.
And I guess it's not too surprising, but a large percentage said they would like to have access to their doctors through these types of social media. A lot of them wanted a lot more access than they currently have, because there's this growing sense for wanting to have control over communication. And I think that part is a good thing. I don't know whether or not I would want patients, matter of fact, I wouldn't want patients communicating with me via Facebook about medical things. That I wouldn't want. What about you?
Definitely. Not via Facebook, probably, but I know a large upspringing of electronic health records that are secure. That might be a better venue for communicating.
Right, to our current Epic,
correct,
which is our electronic medical record. This was actually published in the Journal of the General Internal Medicine. And I think this is growing, and I think it's going to be increasingly an issue. Like, how do we increase electronic communication but also keep boundaries?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that the study found was that people who are most likely to reach out to their doctor electronically were non-white, people who are younger than 45, so us of the Facebook technology generation, and then those with higher incomes.
Yeah. So as this filters down, I'm sure we'll be talking about it some more, but not on Facebook.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, about implantable defibrillators after a heart attack. That's something I hadn't really thought a lot about, but I'm thinking about it now.
Yeah, definitely. So fewer than 1 in 10 older heart attack survivors gets a potentially life-saving implantable defibrillator. So that's a really low amount of people that were or really high amount of people that were missing who could potentially get this treatment.
Right. It's not like everyone who has a heart attack, and we could define what it exactly means to have a heart attack, but damage of some sort, needs an implantable defibrillator. But clearly, these researchers believe, studying data on over 10,000 heart attack patients who were listed in a national database, those who had gotten an implantable defibrillator had a third lower risk of death after 2 years compared to those who didn't. That's pretty impressive data.
That is pretty impressive data. And so this study was published in June in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And, you know, I think it raises the question that some patients who aren't getting these implantable defibrillators after a heart attack probably should be. And the question is why? And some reasons are it costs a lot of money.
Correct. And is there a communication barrier between the inpatient or the hospital side? And then when they get back out into the clinical setting, is there something that is getting kind of lost in translation that maybe they would be a good
You have to
patient.
Wait a month or a month and a half right. after you've had the heart attack and discharged from the hospital. And that it can cost $25,000 to $30,000, but Medicare covers it. So you know what? I think if you have a loved one who is older and has had a heart attack, maybe even younger, it's something to ask your doctor about, ask your primary care doctor, ask your cardiologist. I think this is important.
Definitely. So the next one we're going to talk about is a new therapy that could potentially ease fibromyalgia, and that is with hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
Which I better say that again.
So
this isn't just like, take a deep breath.
Right. Yeah. So these are cylindrical, very high percentages of oxygen that typically we know to treat things like when scuba divers come up too quickly to treat decompression illness, and actually chronic wounds sometimes are treated in these as well. But now this study finds that it may help fibromyalgia as well.
Yeah, it was really quite interesting that up to 70% of the patients in this study, which was published in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One, were after they had had these oxygen therapy, which were pretty significant, 40 therapy treatments over 2 months, 5 times a week, 90 minutes each session.
That's quite a commitment.
More than I probably could do. But you know what? If you've got the pain, there may be a gain because they breathe 100% oxygen. And 70% were said they may not have the fibromyalgia after the treatment, suggesting there could be a benefit, which I think they're going to have to do some randomized controlled trials, some better studies, given the cost, given the invasiveness of this.
Definitely.
And potential side effects of the treatment, which too much oxygen over too long a period of time could cause some pulmonary hypertension.
Exactly. And so this is still currently off-label and not quite yet FDA approved, but I think you're right. Some more studies would definitely
And to
be
understand
warranted.
The mechanism of why this may work, it could lead to some important advancements for fibromyalgia. Well, speaking of important advancements, there's something right under our nose a lot of times, which is slightly elevated blood pressure, you know, for the young adult who comes in, maybe who has a sinus infection or some other problem, we see a slightly elevated blood pressure, say, oh, you're ill, blood pressure's a little high, don't worry about it.
Right.
Are we giving the right advice?
Yeah, definitely. This is an interesting article that was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology in June of 2015, where researchers followed nearly 2,500 men and women over the course of 25 years, and they started to follow them when they were between 18 and 30, and then afterwards found that those who had slightly elevated blood pressure, just a little bit, but still within the normal range, were more likely to have problems with their left ventricle when they reached middle age.
Yeah, they're more likely to essentially develop those early warning signs of heart failure or having heart problems. And so it's like, whoa, this slightly elevated blood pressure is probably something to at least be aware of. And perhaps maybe we need to change our message a little bit when that person's coming in for that sinus infection, which is like, you know, your blood pressure is actually a little elevated. I'd like us to monitor that a couple times and see what's going on here, or other ways of perhaps lowering the blood pressure, like losing weight.
Yeah, definitely. And having them come back, because these young people are probably more healthy overall. So they see their doctor once a year, and it's really important. If you see it slightly elevated in that one visit, maybe have them come back and double check.
Yeah, well, that's some interesting research that matters that'll conclude what we can talk about. But we've had a chance to talk about that. You know, even slightly elevated blood pressure when you come in and you're young is not necessarily normal.
And that a new therapy may ease fibromyalgia, the hyperbaric oxygen chambers.
Though it needs more research, and probably not for everyone given the cost, that these implantable defibrillators perhaps are being used too little on the United States population and maybe worldwide after people have had a heart attack.
And then a continued discussion on exactly where the boundaries are for good patient care and then communication with doctors via social media like Facebook or email.
We'll post this discussion on Facebook.
Sounds like a good idea.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. When we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. James Ford, Assistant Professor and Director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program at the University of North Carolina, about pulmonary hypertension. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gulsey and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Coe. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we're talking with Dr. James Ford, assistant professor and director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program and co-director of the University of North Carolina Pulmonary Clinic, about pulmonary hypertension.
Yeah, and we'll get into a little bit about what that is exactly. But for right now, welcome, Dr. Ford. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Of course. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind starting out by just telling us a little bit about your journey into medicine, specifically pulmonary medicine, which is the study of the lungs and lung-related medicine. And how did you get to UNC? It looks like you started off in Florida.
Yes. So how I got into medicine? Well, I guess, like many people do, was interested in science and wanted to help people. But, you know, once you get into it, you start to realize your more specific interests. I got into internal medicine. Wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, if I even wanted to subspecialize. And then as I did rotations in the intensive care unit, really became interested in critical care medicine. And that's how I think a lot of people get into pulmonary and critical care, is via the ICU, the excitement of intensive care. And pulmonary disease is really paired along with that in terms of training. So that's what got me into it. And then when I started my fellowship, we really didn't have a very cohesive, organized pulmonary hypertension program at UNC. And it was really a disease that was, there were a lot of new therapies on the horizon, and a lot of new research and a lot of excitement in the field, but really didn't have an organized program at UNC. So as part of my research and sort of specialty endeavor in my fellowship, I sought pulmonary hypertension and really organized a clinic and got involved with some industry-sponsored research studies for new therapies. Where we started doing our own right heart catheterizations in the cardiac cath lab, which is how you diagnose pulmonary hypertension.
Well, let's take a step back for just one second.
Sure.
What is pulmonary hypertension? Everyone knows pulmonary is lung, hypertension, high blood pressure. You combine those two terms and whoop, right over my head. Tell us what it is.
Right. So, and actually, I'm glad you asked that, because semantics, or what you call it, are very important. So pulmonary hypertension is a very general term. It simply means that the blood pressure within the pulmonary arteries that go through the lungs, which are what are involved in uptaking oxygen and releasing carbon dioxide, there's something wrong with them. And the pressure is high in them, and that can happen for a number of different reasons. So when we think about pulmonary hypertension, we really group it into different categories or classifications to help us think about how to approach different patients and how to treat them. And there's another term called pulmonary arterial hypertension, which you may have also heard of, or PAH. And that's a very important and different process under the umbrella of pulmonary hypertension. And that really denotes that there's something actually intrinsically wrong with those pulmonary arteries, more so on the smaller microscopic pulmonary arterioles and pulmonary capillaries. And they sort of get plugged up.
Well, why should we care about this? I mean, because if this were something that affected 1 out of 10 million people, we would say, oh, important, rare disease, good thing, versus this is like high blood pressure that, you know, 10-15% of the population easily has. Woo, everyone should care about it. Where are we? Because I have a sense that this is like important, but a lot of people don't know it.
Right. So pulmonary arterial hypertension, while rare, is probably more common than we think it is. And there are many things, disease processes associated with pulmonary arterial hypertension. So that's the one we care about the most, that pulmonary hypertension programs and centers really care about identifying, because that's the type of pulmonary hypertension that our therapies are targeted after. And what we're really trying to prevent is right-sided heart failure. So what happens is, as those pulmonary arteries become diseased and it's harder for blood to flow through them, it's harder for the right side of the heart to pump that blood into those arteries and arterioles and capillaries, and it ultimately will become enlarged and weak and fail.
Because the right side of the heart is pumping to the lungs.
Correct.
And if those lungs are not doing right, it's putting a lot of strain on the right heart.
Correct.
So one of the symptoms might be kind of swelling in the lower legs, but lots of different diseases can cause that. So what should patients be on the lookout for and really ask their doctor to maybe look more into this diagnosis of pulmonary arterial or just pulmonary hypertension?
Right. So swelling in the legs can certainly be a sign of pulmonary hypertension, more so as it becomes more advanced and the right side of the heart begins to decompensate or fail. But shortness of breath, as is the case with a multitude of different lung diseases.
Right.
As the disease worsens, patients may feel lightheaded or have episodes of passing out or feeling like they're going to pass out. May feel palpitations or even chest discomfort as the disease becomes more advanced and more serious.
What you're talking about here down south, but many places across the country, the symptoms of a little swelling in the legs, a little shortness of breath, particularly in summer, and my chest didn't feel so good because I was out there mowing the lawn, those seem like those are really kind of common sorts of things. What gets me thinking a little bit beyond the common? Why should, you know, I know, for instance, my patients who smoke who have emphysema, a lot of them develop difficulty with their lungs. Is this the sort of thing that I should be looking for?
Well, so when we approach a patient with shortness of breath, we look for more common things and do simpler tests, physical examination, a directed history, and do things like a chest x-ray, maybe an EKG, maybe some pulmonary function tests. And if at that point we still don't have a clear answer as to why our patient is experiencing shortness of breath or swelling in the legs or any of the symptoms we discussed, then we may go on to do what's called an echocardiogram, or evaluation of the heart with an ultrasound, which can help us look for left-sided heart problems or the typical congestive heart failure, if you will, typically caused by hypertension associated with diabetes and other medical problems. But it can also show us what the right side of the heart looks like. And it can help us to estimate what the pressures might be on the right side of the heart, which gives us a window as to what they might be within the pulmonary arteries. And I do stress the word estimate because it's not the gold standard to really diagnose pulmonary hypertension.
What is that gold standard?
So the gold standard is, I mentioned right heart catheterization. That is the gold standard.
Because stick a catheter through the groin or the arm up to the heart.
Correct. We actually usually go through the jugular vein in the neck simply because it allows patients to recover more quickly if all we're trying to do is a right heart catheterization. But you can also go through the groin, and that's typically how left heart catheterizations are done. Yeah,
you should be grateful, Catherine, and I actually don't do either of those approaches.
Yeah, definitely.
Our approach is to pick up the phone and call you.
Right.
Excellent.
And why? What kinds of conditions do people have that might begin to lead them? What are the conditions? What are the causes?
Right. So the most common causes of pulmonary hypertension in general are actually left-sided heart failure. So what happens is as left-sided heart failure progresses and the left side of the heart gets weak, it actually causes blood to back up, if you will, and that backs up into the lungs, into the pulmonary arteries, and they just sort of fill up, and it causes the pressure to go up. But it's not really because there's something actually wrong with the pulmonary blood vessels themselves. It's sort of like a pipe just sort of filling up and becoming overextended, overdistended. Lung diseases like COPD, emphysema, and pulmonary fibrosis can also cause pulmonary hypertension because patients with those problems tend to have low oxygen levels, and it causes the blood vessels in the lungs to constrict, and that raises the pressure in the lungs. So, but again, that's not because there's actually an intrinsic problem with those vessels. It's because they're constricting due to low oxygen levels. So,
what about things like sleep apnea or obstructive sleep apnea? Is that a cause of pulmonary hypertension?
Absolutely, and that falls into the same category as COPD, emphysema, and fibrosis, because that disorder is often associated with drops in oxygen saturation with sleep as well.
So obesity is a major risk factor, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that in a couple minutes. But I'm thinking back to my father of blessed memory who had pulmonary fibrosis and ultimately had pulmonary hypertension and passed away. And this was, 15, 18 years ago. At the time, there was no treatments. Do we have some treatments? I know we'll spend a lot more time after the break talking about it, but do we have treatments now?
We certainly do. But we don't really know what best to do for folks who have pulmonary fibrosis or left heart failure or COPD or sleep apnea that's associated with pulmonary hypertension. We think of it as a secondary process, but we don't have good therapies or trials to show us how to treat that type of pulmonary hypertension. But pulmonary arterial hypertension, which is associated with a number of conditions, including connective tissue diseases like lupus and scleroderma, or even HIV, or liver cirrhosis, or congenital heart diseases. That type of pulmonary arterial hypertension, we have actually a number of therapies available, and most of them have come in the last 20 years.
Well, we'll talk about those in a little bit, but we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be continue talking with our guest, Dr. James Ford, assistant professor and director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program at the University of North Carolina, about pulmonary hypertension. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koch.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We've been talking with Dr. James Ford, assistant professor and director of Pulmonary Hypertension Program at UNC, as well as the co-director of the UNC Pulmonary Clinic. And we, before the break, were discussing pulmonary hypertension and pulmonary arterial hypertension and kind of the things that can lead to it, such as left-sided heart failure, COPD, emphysema, and then for the arterial hypertension part, things like connective tissue diseases. We were just about to start talking about what treatments are available and kind of the research around that. Wondering if you could kind of give us a basic overview of the treatments that are available.
Sure. So there's really three main classes of treatment that we have currently. The first treatment for pulmonary arterial hypertension is actually the most complex treatment that we have available for pulmonary arterial hypertension, even still today. And that's called Flolan, is the brand name for it, otherwise known as epoprostenol. And that was actually approved in the mid-90s based on a small trial which showed significant improvement in survival in patients who were treated with that drug. And it's actually a continuous infusion therapy whereby patients have an indwelling catheter in their, one of their large central veins, and are hooked up to an ambulatory infusion pump.
It sounds expensive. Does it work?
It is indeed expensive, and it does work when given to the appropriate patient in most cases, yes. But thankfully, we have also evolved to come to have oral therapies as well as inhaled therapies for pulmonary arterial hypertension as well. One of the other classes of drugs are those known as endothelin receptor antagonists, and those were the first oral therapies that were approved for pulmonary arterial hypertension. And they block a substance which really causes a lot of vasoconstriction of the pulmonary blood vessels. And then another category are the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, and you may know them as erectile dysfunction drugs like sildenafil, which is Viagra, and tadalafil, which is marketed as Cialis, have been studied in pulmonary arterial hypertension. They cause dilation of the pulmonary arteries as well, and have shown to be effective in PAH as well.
So what's interesting, which is that pulmonary arterial hypertension, the only reason I really know about those drugs for that condition is I had a patient come in not too long ago, someone quite elderly, who wanted like 240 tablets of Viagra. And I was like, well, you can't get 240 wow. tablets of Viagra. We give 9 a month, you know, in insurance.
Yeah.
But it turned out that I guess either in Europe or for pulmonary arterial hypertension, that would not be an unusual. You might get a 3-month supply, and it's very inexpensive. And this patient, but it was like, well, how come I didn't know about that? So this is knowledge that's been around for a long time.
That's right. And that indeed would be a reasonable dose for a patient being treated for pulmonary arterial hypertension with sildenafil or Viagra. We've really come a long way. In each of these classes, we've developed new therapies, and we currently have 9 oral therapies and 2 inhaled therapies, and another additional continuous infusion therapy in addition to the Flolan available. So there are a lot of options for patients, and we can really choose the treatment based on the severity of the disease and also what the patient may be able to manage in their lifestyle.
And is some of that research about the new therapies being done at UNC? And if so, wondering which ones, and if you could describe it a little bit.
Sure. So we've been involved in some of the trials looking at new treatments and also different approaches to using existing treatments. So one of the questions we've always had in treating pulmonary arterial hypertension is, should patients get one drug to start with? Should they get all three classes of drug to start with? Sort of like a upfront
induction. A shotgun approach versus, right. You know. Yeah,
kind of like a chemotherapy induction, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we really don't know the answers to those questions. Some folks who treat pulmonary arterial hypertension will start one drug, follow the patient down the road, see how they're doing, and if they haven't met treatment goals, add another drug. Other doctors will start with two or three drugs up front. And we really don't know what's the best way to approach it. So we've been involved in some of those trials looking at different combinations, including some new drugs in combination with some drugs we already have on the market. So yes, we've certainly been involved in those.
So I know a lot of listeners out there would be thinking, okay, if I smoke, I probably need to quit. That'll help out at least some of the bad effects on the lungs. If I'm overweight, I need to lose weight. What do we know about prevention, either with lifestyle or with herbal or with other things that we might be able to do, in inhalation, avoiding chlorine? Do we know ways of preventing this?
So when it comes to pulmonary arterial hypertension, unfortunately, we do not know of any ways of preventing that. It's associated with a number of diseases, some of which can be prevented to an extent. For example, cirrhosis is associated with pulmonary arterial hypertension in some patients. In some cases, alcoholism is linked to cirrhosis. But apart from those sorts of circumstances, we don't really have a clear thing to avoid or way to prevent pulmonary arterial hypertension. Now, some of the secondary causes, like you mentioned, left heart failure, lung diseases such as COPD and emphysema, which are associated with other lifestyle choices such as smoking, poor diet, lack of exercise in the case of heart disease in some patients. In those areas, we can make some differences in terms of primary prevention.
And what about lung transplants? Is there any role?
Absolutely. So lung transplant is the only truly curative therapy for pulmonary arterial hypertension. And we refer patients for lung transplant evaluation, usually if they are on all three classes of drug and are still not meeting treatment goals, are still getting worse, are still having significant impairments in their ability to exert themselves and having significant shortness of breath, and right-sided heart failure, despite our best efforts.
I want to also spend a little bit of time talking about the program at UNC that you have. So you're the director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program, which was recently accredited as a comprehensive care center by the Pulmonary Hypertension Association, one of only 26 in the country and the first in North Carolina. What does your program offer to patients with pulmonary hypertension?
Right, sure. So the whole idea behind the comprehensive care center was really to identify centers where appropriate techniques are employed to diagnose patients. So all patients are getting a right heart catheterization before you ever consider putting them on PAH therapies. And that's really important because if you put a patient who really doesn't have PAH but maybe has a secondary form of pulmonary hypertension on a PAH therapy, they may actually get worse and have worsening shortness of breath.
Gotcha.
But in addition, the ability to treat patients with the complicated infusion therapies is really something for which you've got to have the infrastructure and staff support and clinical support. So we have a nurse coordinator who works full-time with our patients in our program whose principal job is to help patients with problems that may develop from side effects of their drug, getting the drugs authorized, which is a very a significant process,
sure.
And very time-consuming process. Following up on patients who are on continuous infusions, making sure they're not having so many side effects that they're not able to continue to increase the dose of their drug. And just making sure the patients are seen at appropriate follow-up intervals, that they're getting the appropriate follow-up diagnostic testing. And there's really a good effort made to make sure they're meeting treatment goals, that we're not just putting them on therapy and then letting them sort of go six months down the road.
You know, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, you mentioned side effects of drugs. Are there certain drugs, we were talking before the show started about the fen-phen, the weight loss combination, fenfluramine, phentermine that was used a decade ago and caused significant amount of pulmonary hypertension, or at least enough that it was withdrawn from the market. Are there drugs that we need to be aware of or that people should be alert to?
Sure. So, and within that same class of drugs you mentioned, we call them the anorexigens. They're really amphetamine derivatives. And any drug that's sort of in that class makes us concerned. But particularly methamphetamine and cocaine have also been associated with pulmonary arterial hypertension. So in terms of exposures and drugs that would put one at risk for PAH, those would be the primary ones that folks would be familiar with.
Well, you know, we appreciate you starting this clinic and your leadership at UNC. I must ask one last real quick question. As a critical care doctor, I know before you came on the radio show, you were out visiting, taking care of critical care patients. What is your most memorable experience taking care of critical care patients? Can you just share one memorable experience? Because you were doing pretty life-saving, pretty critical work.
Right. Well, hard to identify just one, but I can say that the patient who comes in, particularly a young, otherwise healthy patient who has a very catastrophic event, has respiratory failures, on a ventilator, and we just can't get enough oxygen into them despite being on maximal ventilator support. They maybe go off and have a really heroic thing like something called ECMO done, which is stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, a way to get oxygen into the body by bypassing the lungs. And then to see a patient like that actually get better and pull through all of that and walk back into the ICU and say, hey, I made it. You know, there's been a few instances where that's happened, and I think those are the things that really stick out.
I bet you get some big hugs sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
Well, we would give you a big hug today because we can't thank you enough for coming and sharing your time and experience with us. We've been talking with Dr. James Ford, Assistant Professor and Director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program at the University of North Carolina, about pulmonary hypertension. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Calls segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
We'd like to ask our guest executive producer today, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question.
My uncle had severe, life-threatening heart failure, and we thought he would die within a year. His doctors got together and decided he would benefit from an implantable defibrillator, which he had 6 months ago. Amazingly, he regained two-thirds of his heart function. How does that happen?
Wow.
Do you know Adam Goldstein?
Well, you know, what's interesting is we talked about the implantable defibrillators in the Research That Matters portions of the show and showing that there was a two-thirds reduction and these people had had a heart attack, it really, you know, helped them out here. And, you know, I need to look into the mechanism here, but clearly there's something about in some subset of patients, not only as we think about implantable defibrillators cutting down on the chance of the heart having, you know, atrial or ventricular fibrillation, sudden death, there's something about the regulation and the electroactivity of the heart. Because in this particular patient, it's clear that their heart failure significantly improved, which is a great thing.
Yeah. So while we don't know exactly how or why, it still highlights the importance of a patient advocating or family advocating for those loved ones who may have either had a heart attack or have really bad heart failure to talk with their doctors about whether or not an implantable defibrillator is a right thing for them.
Yeah. I think that perhaps it is something that we all need to be learning more about. We'll ask our health science librarians, our wonderful colleagues and collaborators, to put up some information about these implantable defibrillators, a good evidence-based source of this, on our website so our listeners can hear about this a little bit more.
Great.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My wife was recently in the hospital for cellulitis of her leg, for which she was treated with 2 weeks of antibiotics. 3 weeks after the antibiotics stopped, the cellulitis returned, and now they say she needs another 4 weeks of antibiotics. She's very overweight. Why didn't they just start with 6 weeks of medicine?
That is a very good question.
Well, Catherine, this
– Yeah.
Well, this, you know, what do you think
right.
here? I mean, again, this is like one of those things we talked about on a different, you know, show. It's so much easier in retrospect to say what should be the right thing to do, right?
Right, exactly. Well, it's also, you know, we have ways of thinking, well, typical cellulitis should be gone within 2 weeks. And so that is kind of an appropriate first step. But not every patient responds the same way to treatment. And sometimes it can take a little bit longer.
Well, in this particular case – I think, mentioned that she's very overweight. And so sometimes I've seen in people who really have significant 100, 200, 300 pounds overweight, the tissue itself is very swollen and becomes very difficult for the antibodies to get in there. And they may need 2 weeks, 2 months, maybe even longer sometimes of these antibiotics because it just resolves very slowly.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the good news is that she probably will get better and hopefully maybe losing some weight, maybe needing some compression stockings. Other ways of maybe trying to prevent this would be part of the treatment.
Yeah, and sometimes longer courses of antibiotics do have risks associated with them as well, which is probably why in the initial outset you try and do a more conservative two-week therapy to reduce that risk.
Yeah, very good point. Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My mom has atrial fibrillation and is on Coumadin. She has a really hard time regulating it. Her doctor recently recommended trying a drug called Xarelto. It seems like a good idea, but it's really expensive. What are your thoughts?
Great question. Definitely a newer medicine that is out, but gaining a lot of popularity because you don't have to check it so much. So things like Coumadin, which is also known as warfarin, can really vary based on someone's diet and other outside factors. And so if she's having a really hard time regulating it, can talk to your doctor about maybe incorporating a little bit of a low-dose vitamin K for kind of a stable baseline, or something like Xarelto could decrease the amount of times it needs to be checked and followed up on.
Yeah, you know, this question about cost is an interesting one. Mm-hmm. These medicines are expensive. It's going to be several thousand dollars a year, $3,000 to $5,000 at least a year. And yet the cost of a hospitalization for a Coumadin level that's too low, you have a stroke, too high, you bleed, that's cost people don't think about so much. So it's not necessarily straightforward, and it depends on lots of values here. I don't know. I think we have to have joint decision-making here between our patients and the doctors. I'm not sure I can just say, oh, this is one size fits best here.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree.
You know, well, hopefully you can have that conversation with your doctor and then see. Dan, what's our very last house call?
I recently saw my doctor for a routine physical. My blood work showed what he called polycythemia. Other than being tired all the time, I felt good and I was worried that I might be anemic. It turns out I had severe sleep apnea. I started treatment and for the first time in 5 years, I'm not tired. I hope others may benefit from this story.
Well, we appreciate you sharing that story, and that's an important story. There's a lot of words in there. Let's talk about polycythemia.
Polycythemia. So
what's a simple word for?
So poly, many, too many, cythemia, kind of red blood cells.
Right, too many red blood cells. Mm-hmm. I thought that's a good thing, right? anemia, that's a common cause of fatigue. Too many is a problem?
It's kind of like a Goldilocks story here. There's too little is a problem, too many is a problem, but you need to be just right in order for things to be functioning well.
And when there's too many blood cells going through the tubes, it gets sluggish, and that sluggishness can cause kinds of problems like polycythemia, real severe types can actually cause people to have strokes.
Or as we were talking with our guest today, Dr. James Ford, about pulmonary hypertension, that can actually lead to that as well.
Right. So if you're not getting enough oxygen, your body tries to make more of it. So several reasons that can cause polycythemia. One that doctors probably don't think about as much is this sleep apnea.
Definitely.
When you're the overweight and there's excess, your body at night kind of cuts off oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so you're not getting enough oxygen, acts just like the patient with pulmonary hypertension, and that patient starts producing more red blood cells. They become polycythemic, which causes lots of problems, including fatigue, which is what this patient had.
Yeah, definitely. And an important point is that sleep apnea can happen even when people aren't overweight or obese. And so important to talk to your doctor if you have symptoms like snoring and waking up at night.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that a lot of these symptoms got better. A lot of times we hear a lot in medicine where things don't get better and can't quite figure it out. There's too many moving pieces here. This is one where things moved together and things got better, and we're really happy. So congratulations. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. And you can share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or get our health app by searching Your Health for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be on the show again today, Adam.
And we're glad that you could.
And then we'd also like to thank our guest, Dr. James Ford. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.